Okay, we left off in the previous year. We began to discuss a little bit historically the development of Parashat Bapen. The bulk of what we spoke about the first 2 weeks was really the halachic categories of Parashat Bapen. The difference between the different categories of Parashat Bapen. We started to move a little bit more into historically just what Parashat Bapen looked like during the period of Bayis Rishon. And now we began a little bit about throughout the period of Bayis Sheni. I think we came pretty much to the time of the Churban, which was still. We were very much in the period of the Tanoim. I think we just about got to Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, right? We spoke about Shammai Hillel, to meet Shammai Hillel. And one of the most famous, perhaps the most famous Talmud of Hillel, was Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was a pivotal figure in Jewish history, living at the time of the Churban, the famous story in Gittin about how he had the foresight to approach actually the Roman general, who then became the Roman emperor, and to ask him for Yavne, to ask him to give the Jewish people a chance to be able to keep the yeshiva functioning in Yavne. And it was because of that request that ultimately we exist till today. Once Mishnah eventually came into being, and the Gemara came into being, and everything we have today in terms of Torah ultimately boils down to that that most critical decision by Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai lived at a time of the Churban, and it's interesting that the Mishnayos and the Gemaras and the end of Rosh Hashanah and the Sukkah quote a whole series of different takanos, different institutions that Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made, and many of them were revolving actually around the Beis HaMikdash. That because he lived in the generation that last saw the Beis HaMikdash, and he realized that how important it was to keep the Beis HaMikdash alive in the people's hearts, that he made certain takanas for us. Probably the most famous one, at least that we're familiar with, is that he made a takana that you shake a lulav the entire week of Sukkot. You know, Min HaTorah, you only shake a lulav on the first day of Sukkot. And if you're in the Beis HaMikdash, then you smacht and finish the Mekah, Mishav is Yom, then you take the lulav the entire week of Sukkot. If you're chutz l'mikdash, then there's no mitzvah Min HaTorah of taking the lulav. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was misakin to shake a lulav the entire week as a zeichel mikdash. We want to do whatever we can to remember what it was like in the Beis HaMikdash. And many other takanas also that we instituted with this idea of zeichel mikdash. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai continued the Mesorah of his Rebbeim, in particular of Hillel, and continued it not in Yerushalayim anymore, where the Sanhedrin was no longer present in Shalim. The Sanhedrin went to Yavne, had a few other stops in the process also, but things pretty much developed in this little town called Yavne, which became ultimately the center for Parashat Bapeh. It was at this period of time when the Sanhedrin was in Yavne that there were other very famous personalities, some of them the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, individuals such as Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Akiva was a younger member of that group, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, many of the famous personalities from the Seder, Maaseh Elazar, Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, etc. So the bulk of the Torah revolved around Yavne, but in no shape or form did it mean that was the only Makom Torah. There were different places throughout Eretz Yisrael and eventually throughout the world, which were beginning to blossom as Makomos of Torah. Just within Eretz Yisrael itself, Bnei Brak started to become a bastion of Torah, as Rabbi Akiva was the Rav there, as you read in Nagod, there are other cities that were that began to become noted as places of Torah, and there were even, we find already yeshivas, and we find certain Tanoim who are already setting up camp in Chutz Laaretz. We already see the beginnings, and I mean Chutz Laaretz, they don't just mean even in Bothel, I mean in other places in Chutz Laaretz. We already find Tanoim who lived in Rome, quotes of Masi ben Chorash, he's a Tana, he appears in Pirkei Avos, who was a Rosh Hashiva in Rome. The Gemara speaks about Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira lived in Chutz Laaretz also. So they already begin to see Torah centers, somewhat of a foreshadowing of eventually what's going to happen, of course, in much greater degree throughout Jewish history. So the main center is Yavne, that's where the Sanhedrin, the Beis HaNagod was still sitting, even after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and you have these other places that are beginning to develop. Just as an overall in Jewish history, at this time, you're talking about from the year 70, which was the time of the Churban, until the Mishnayos were actually put together, was closer to the year 200, so you're talking about a period of a couple of, you know, three, four generations. There were ups and downs for the Jewish people in, during this time. I mean, obviously the Churban was a tremendous down, but there was another tremendous, several tremendous blows for the Jewish people at this time. One was the death of the Talmidim Rabbi Akiva, and the failed Bar Kokhba revolt, and the destruction of Beitar. Beitar was one of the major Jewish cities in Eretz Yisrael at the time, which was destroyed by the Romans as a follow-up to the Bar Kokhba revolt. You're talking about the decimation, both in terms of the Jewish communities as a whole in Eretz Yisrael, and as we all know, we know from the time, of course, of the Holocaust and other tragedies, that when the Jewish communities are affected, it's obviously the Mekomos HaTorah and the Mechachovim and the Mesorah is also in great danger. And this, in fact, happened at this period. The Gemara Masechet Yevamos describes how after the death of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim, that the whole Haya Olam Shomim, that the world was desolate. I mean, there was a tremendous void in terms of Talmud Torah, until Rabbi Akiva, as an older man, decided that he's going to rededicate himself to teaching Torah, even though he had lost 24,000 Talmidim. But he went ahead and he taught the next generation, his younger Talmidim, and it was in fact Rabbi Akiva's second set of Talmidim, his younger Talmidim, who became the ones who were familiar with his first group of 24,000. We almost know none of them by name, but his younger Talmidim were only five. Do you know who they were? I think we spoke about them in the last cover, right? If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. I think we just read. Who were they? Remember?
Rabbi Meir.
No, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was the Rebbe of. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, this is a perspective. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai's Talmud was Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Eliezer was a Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva. So you're talking about everybody two generations later. So Rabbi Akiva's Talmud, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Elazar was one, Rabbi Shimba Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yossi. Okay, so some say Rabbi Nechemiah, some say instead of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Nechemiah. But whoever it was, there were five major Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, and the Gemara says in Yevamos, they were the ones who continued the Mesorah. And it's not for them, so Torah Chalila would have been forgotten from Klal Yisrael. The Gemara actually says to me, you see this idea that even though a person had Talmidim when he was young, so he should have more Talmidim when he gets older also. And the Gemara says, like with children, just because you have children when you're young, you should try to have as many children as you can, because you never know. The more the merrier, the more children the better, the more students, the more Talmidim the better. So Rabbi Akiva followed these words of advice, and he actually had those extra five Talmidim, and those extra five Talmidim carried the day for all of Klal Yisrael. And it's really this generation that becomes, in a sense, the foundation of the Mishnah. Now again, everything is still building. We already mentioned last time that the Tanoim, who were first mentioned in the Mishnah, will go way, way back. Shimon HaTzadik, when Yosef and Yoezer, the early Tanoim, 100, 200, 300 years before the Churban. But the bulk of the Tanoim literature that we have in the Mishnayos are basically from these two generations, namely the generation of Rabbi Akiva and the generation of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So that's why the names that we always see in the Mishnayos and the Braises all the time: Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Elazar Azaria, then a little bit of the younger generation: Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, etc. Those are the Rabbi Shimon. Those are the major names that we have. So it was after that generation of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva that an individual entered onto the scene of Jewish history who was probably, quite possibly more than any other individual, perhaps even since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe Ezra Sofer also had to play a major role, but somebody who reshaped, in a sense, the destiny of the Mesorah. And who am I referring to?
Rabbi
Yehuda HaNasi. The decision that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi made and the contribution that he had to the Mesorah was so profound that it really, in a sense, changed everything. The whole style, the whole essence of how Torah Shabbat presents itself was really changed drastically due to the work of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So who was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and what exactly was his role? What was his historical background? So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a descendant of Hillel. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's father was, anyone else?
Rabbi Shimon Gamliel,
whose father was Rabbi Gamliel, whose father was Rabbi Shimon, whose father was Rabbi Gamliel, whose father was Rabbi Shimon, whose father was Hillel. Okay, then you got them all. It's easy names to remember. They kept it in the family. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the Nasi, was the prince, who was the Nasi HaSanhedrin, was the leader of the Sanhedrin, as his father had been, his grandfather, great-grandfather, etc. had been. Yehuda HaNasi had, the Gemara describes him, said, as Gittin, that he was Torah Gedulah B'Mokhem Echad, that on the one hand he was the Gadol Hador, he was beyond doubt he was the Gadol Hador, but he also had, which we'll see in a moment, became very critical for this undertaking, he had tremendous financial wealth, and he had tremendous of connections with the Roman government, and in fact, his generation was zocheh to a certain degree of tolerance by the Roman government. Now, the Jewish relationship with the Roman emperors had its ups and downs. There were times when the situation was terrible, like in the days of Rabbi Akiva, he was actually killed by the Romans for teaching Torah. There were decrees during that period of time against the teaching of Torah. So you had certain times during the Roman conquest of Eretz Yisrael, the situation was horrendous. And then you had certain breaks in the actions and breathing spaces, and this is in fact what happened. The Rida Nasi developed, not only was there was the climate good for Kreisel as a whole, but there was actually a personal relationship between the emperor, Antoninus, Anthony, whichever Anthony it was, and Rabbi Danossi. And this enabled Rabbi Danossi to that yeshiva hadas, that amount of literally run for your life, gave him the ability of clarity to be able to work on his major project. What was Rabbi Danossi's project? Rabbi Danossi realized that the situation with Klai Yisrael was not getting better as a whole in terms of their relationship with the outside world. Now, true, here and there were a couple of breathing spaces, but as a whole, Rabbi Danossi realized, rightfully so, that the situation was rather bleak. Here, the Beis Hamikdash didn't exist. There was no Jewish authority. Yerushalayim was in total state of churban. Whatever Torah was around had been moved now to the north. The Beis subsequently left Yavne, was in Tveria, and that whole area of the Galil that we were just in the other day was really the center of Torah. The yeshivas were already beginning to sprout in Bavel and in Rome and in other parts of the world. And Rabbi Danossi realized that there is, number one, going to be a decentralization of Torah. Clearly, as the Golos continues, it had already been 130 years since the time of the Churban, and it didn't look like the Beis Hamikdash was going to be rebuilt in any given second. It was hard to know. We hope it would, but we don't have any assurances. And Rabbi Danossi realized that since the previous generation had undergone such tsaros just to survive, so who knows what's going to be, what's going to happen to the next generation. And he was very, very concerned that the Torah may be forgotten, that the Torah Shebaaleh may actually be forgotten by Klal Yisrael. Now, this was, the situation had gotten worse because of the whole development of Machlokas that we spoke about in the past. That Machlokas had been something which had been somewhat unheard of in the past in the sense of unresolved Machlokasim. But now, in the previous two, three generations, the whole idea of an unresolved Machlokas had entered into Klal Yisrael. Beis HaGadol was not functioning to the extent that it had in the past. And Rabbi Danossi was very concerned, very weary about the future, rightfully so. And he decided to do something which was drastic, both halakhically and historically. He decided to, in a sense, organize the Torah Shebaaleh Peh in a way that it hadn't really been organized until that point. And even more drastic than that was to actually put the Torah Shebaaleh Peh into writing. Now, that in and of itself is a very controversial statement, because l'chora, by its very name, Torah Shebaaleh Peh, it's not supposed to be in writing. If it was supposed to be in writing, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have written down the Gemara for Moshe Rabbeinu. So for way over 1,000 years, 1,500 years, more 1,700 years since the days of Matan Torah, till the days of Rabbi Danossi, it was understood that Torah Shebaaleh Peh has to be Be'al Peh. In fact, there are halachic reasons why it has to be Be'al Peh. And Rabbi Danossi was, in a sense, what he used the word change, Allah, Rabbi Danossi changed the practice of learning Torah Shebaaleh Peh. He felt that the reason why it was permitted to change the practice was to justify what he did. Rabbi Danossi claimed that in order to ensure the continuity of Torah, that is more important than to observe the halacha of keeping the Torah Shebaaleh Peh Be'al Peh. And therefore, the Gemara puts the pasuk, that sometimes that the Beis Din is allowed to decide if they think that for the greater good of the Limud Torah, it's better that we commit the Torah Shebaaleh Peh to writing, so be it. And Rabbi Danossi actually did it, and the Mishnayos were composed. Rabbi Danossi, it wasn't just such an easy thing to collect Mishnayos. The Mishnayos were teachings that Rabbi Meir had his set of teachings, and Rabbi Kiva had his sets, and Rabbi Loz, all the Tanoim had their particular Nusuch, had their particular Tamidim were there taught to, and there were different opinions. Rabbi Danossi tried to combine together all the opinions. Those opinions that he felt were the correct halacha. Him and his Beis Din, they decided and they sifted through and they worked through all of Ash'as from beginning to end, and all Ash'as in terms of Mishnayos, and anything Rabbi Danossi and his Beis Din and his generation felt should be the halacha, they presented as a Stam Mishnah, they presented as just without giving a name. If they wanted to present another opinion that they felt was not accepted by halacha, but they didn't want to leave it out of the Mishnah, so they would write. So Rabbi Kiva Omer such and such, so Rabbi Yeshua Omer such and such, and basically Rabbi Yehuda Anasi divided up all of Teshuva Peh into six categories. The six categories, of course, that we have, the Shisha Sidra Mishnah. So Zerayim, just a quick overview. So Zerayim, of course, deals with Inyanim of agricultural halachas, Truma, Shemitah, things of that nature. Moe deals with Shabbos and Yom Tovim. Nashim deals with Kiddushin and Gittin and anything related to Yavavs, Ksubas, things that are related to marriage. Nezikin are the Bavas and Sanhedrin and Makas, things which are related to court cases and to Mamanus. Kachim is the Beis HaMikdash, and Taras are all the halachas of Tumah V'Tara. So Rida Nasi was the one who made that division, and then he further subdivided the Teshuvah Peh, he further subdivided the Sedarim into Masechta. So we have each self-enclosed unit, so to speak, as to a different topic in terms of the Torah Shabbat Peh. So this idea of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi became very popular, and people's learnings began to revolve around the Torah Shabbat Peh, as had been categorized by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. So whereas in the past, if a person wanted to say a shiur, let's say for argument's sake, I wanted to say a shiur on a sugya about sukkah, so how would I start the shiur? I would open up a Sefer Torah, and I would read the pasuk, l'kachtem lechem yom rishon, sukkah stesh shiv yomim, and then I would teach whatever halachas I had to say, and then I would discuss, well, what's the shiur of a sukkah? Does it have to be this big, that big, the other big? Everything would start around the pasuk in Chumash, and the Torah Shabbat would relate directly to the pasuk in Chumash. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's, after his work of compiling the Mishnah, all the Torah Shabbat Peh discussions now began to revolve around the Mishnah. Now everybody in the next generation started to rather than learning from the Chumash directly, started to discuss the Mishnahs and try to figure out what the Mishnah mean, what did Rabbi Nasi mean. And then there was a whole discussion, because the Mishnah obviously by its very nature can't give you every single detail of Torah Shabbat Peh. It gives you the Rosh Hashanah, it gives you the basic facts, but that's the reason the Mishnah very, very rarely explains how anybody knew what the reason for any particular halacha was. So the Mishnah will just present Amar Rabbi Akiva this and Amar Rabbi Shmuel that. Now what will the Gemara do? So the Gemara will ask, well, Menon Avili, how did Rabbi Akiva know what he held? And the Gemara will explain, give the traditional understanding of why Rabbi Akiva said what he said, why did Rabbi Eliezer disagree, and the Gemara will discuss the pros and cons, and the Gemara will sometimes point out, hey, wait a second, how could this Mishnah say this if another Mishnah says that, and try to give an answer, and then another Gemara will give another answer. So what started to happen was all the discussion began to revolve, rather than around the Chumash itself, began to revolve around the Mishnayos, which became, in a sense, the repository of all the Torah Shabbat Peh. Everything that had been discussed in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi basically became incorporated into the Mishnah. So it's very hard to know. We have a Stam Mishnah, so we don't know really how old that Mishnah was. I mean, you have this teaching that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi says. It could be this was something that was Neschadish 800 years ago, in the beginning of Bais Rishon. It could be something that was Neschadish 50 years ago. It could be something that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi himself was Neschadish. It's very hard to know, but it doesn't really make a difference, because it's all the Torah Shabbat Peh. Everything was derived with the same basic rules of derivation. No one's doing anything different. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi didn't do anything different in terms of his analysis of halacha. What he did was, with his categorization of halacha, was critical, and particularly the decision to commit the Torah Shabbat Peh to writing. At the same time that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was working on the Mishnayos, there were other Tanaitic sources, the Tanaim, the people who lived at that time, there were other things that were being compiled as well. Anyone know some other Svarim that were being compiled similar to the Mishnah? There were Toseftas that were being put together, which were also compilations of different statements of Tanaim. There were Brisas that were being put together as well, and there were different sets of Brisas. There were also, there were certain Svarim that were written directly on Chumash. They were?
Taras
Kohanim was like a running parish of Pialocha of Sefer Yikra. What else? The Sifrei was being written, was the parish Halacha on the Midman Devarim, and the third one? The Sifrei was the Midman Devarim, and the Chilta. No, the Sifra and Taras Kohanim was the same thing. So there were three So there are three Sifri Halacha that were written as running commentaries on the Torah Shemiksav. One was the Mechilta and Sefer Shmos, starting from Pachodesh Zalachem. One was the Torah Shkonim, something called the Sifra and Sefer Vayikra. One was Sifrei on Mevidus Varim. Obviously, Bereishis does not going to have one because there's very, very little Halacha in Sefer Bereishis. So all of this was being really put together pretty much at the time, right before Rabbi Danasi joined the Fit of Rabbi Danasi. And now you had a whole bunch of different sources of written material now that basically comprised all of Tosh about that. What now began to happen after the period of Rabbi Danasi in the generation of his first generation of Tamidim was all of these Tanoim material now served as the source of the discussion in the Beis Medrash. So now if you walked into a Beis Medrash in Tveria, for argument's sake, you know, right after Mishnah was compiled, so no doubt the discussion would begin to revolve around the Mishnah, but also no doubt there would be a question and say, wait a second, how can the Mishnah say this? The Torah Kodim says this. Oh, must be a Machlokes. Why does the Torah Kodim say this? Or why does this Braisa, the Braisa with different Tanoim that Rabbi Danasi didn't incorporate into the Mishnah, but why does the Mishnah say this, and why did the Braisa say this? Is it a Machlokes? There are two different cases. And again, the whole style of Gemara that we're familiar with was all revolving around the Mishnah, but using the other sources and using questions and answers and rayas and proofs and disproofs, back and forth and reasonings, this all became the Derech Ali in this period of time. Okay. So this was all at the period immediately following Rabbi Danasi, see the first generation of Amoraim.
Why didn't they just take the Mishnah for face value and accept
it as a halacha? Well, it would be a closed book if we would just accept it at face value, because we want to know what the reason for the Mishnah is. If you don't know the reason for it, then there's no way for you to ever extrapolate to another case. It's like, let's say a person wants to learn halacha, they just open up a kid's shulchan aruch or something, and they don't have any idea where anything comes from, so it's going to be very, very difficult for them to apply the halacha properly. Right? So the Mishnah is there as a format, but now everything is, so even though there is the Torah Shebichsav, the Mishnah has now in a sense become quote unquote the Torah Shebichsav, the Torah Shebapeh still there, with all the explanations and the kashas and tirism, etc. So this work to clarify the Mishnah and clarify the Braises and the Torah Konims and all this work began now the avoda of the first generation of Tamidim of Rabbi Danasi, and this is really where the line of demarcation is between the time of the Tanoim and the time of the Amoraim. So now beginning to discuss the first generation of Amoraim. So the first generation of Amoraim were many of them were the Tamidim of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Most of them were in fact the actual Tamidim. So everyone knows who are some of the famous names of the Tamidim of Hanasi who were the first generation?
Rav Asher
was way, way later.
Rav
was a Talmud of Rabbi Hanasi. Rav originally was from Bavel and that way to Israel. He was there a few times. Everyone knows what his real name was?
Abba.
His name was Abba. Abba Richa. He was very tall. They used to call him the tall Abba. But his they used to call him Rav. He was just the Rav, the rabbi. Who was some other Tamidim?
Rabbi
Chia. Rabbi Chia was a. Everyone else? Another name? Shmuel was a little bit later. Okay, so Rabbi Yochanan was a little bit later. He had to. Because it was a couple of generations later. So these were all pretty much the first generation of Amoraim. So you had really a breakdown, a first generation of Amoraim. At this time, there was a lot of travel between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. And you began to see now that some of the major yeshivas in Bavel are beginning to sprout. Even though the Jewish community existed in Bavel already for hundreds of years, from the time already of Churban Bayis Rishon, but the actions, I was not in Bavel. There were things going on in Bavel, but it was not the seat of Jewish learning by any stretch of the imagination during the period of Vayisheni. So, but now things began slowly to change, and again, a lot of the change was for historical reasons. That the situation in Eretz Yisrael began to deteriorate, as Rabbi Danasi had already noticed, had already suspected it's going to happen. Whereas the situation in Bavel was fairly good. Again, that doesn't mean that there weren't downs in Bavel also, but the period of the Amoraim, by and large, was pretty decent in Bavel. Bavel again was not under the Roman rule, was under the Persian rule, which had its ups and downs. Anybody here learning Daf Yomi? There's a Gemara in Tamar Daf Yomi about the difference between the Persian rule and the Roman rule and the Babylonian rule, which is better for the Jews, which is worse for the Jews, etc. So again, so you now begin to see really two different groups of Talmidim of Rabbi Nasi develop. You have the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, the Amoraim who remain in Eretz Yisrael. Then you have the Amoraim who are pretty much from Babel. Many of them came to Eretz Yisrael actually to learn Rabbi Nasi. So the two major players at this time in Babel were who? The first generation of Amoraim, the two major players, Arav and Shmuel. Okay, Rav was the Rosh Yeshiva in Sura. Sura was a yeshiva that existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. It still existed in the period of the Gaonim. So you're talking about almost close to the 1,000 that the yeshiva was still functioning. So Rav was Rosh Yeshiva in Sura, and Shmuel was Rosh Yeshiva of, I don't know. Nahardah was a very significant Jewish town with a major Makom Torah, major yeshiva. And Shmuel was the Rosh Yeshiva. Nahardah had a very short life. The yeshiva, the whole town was destroyed, it was burnt. So I don't remember whether it was a persecution type of burning, whether it was just an accident. Whatever it was, Nahardah did not have such a long history after the period of Shmuel. And eventually other yeshivas in Babel began to crop up from Padisa and Asmachatz and other places, which became a Kamas of Torah a little bit later on. But this first generation, so Sura was a mainstay, and Nahardah was a mainstay. That was in Babel. In Eretz Israel, so the major Amoraim, who was some of the major Amoraim in Eretz Israel this time? Rabbi Yochanan, not to be confused with Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, but Rabbi Yochanan, Rish Lakish, his brother-in-law Rish Lakish, the famous story of Rabbi Tzvi about Rish Lakish was originally a robber, and then Rabbi Yochanan found him and told him he'll marry his sister, and then he becomes Baal Tshuva, and he did a whole beautiful story of Rabbi Tzvi. So Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Rish Lakish, Rabbi Elazar, he had a few major players in terms of the first generation of Amoraim. And then we move on to the next generation, the second generation of Amoraim. So now there were some important developments, particularly in Eretz Yisrael at this time. And here we find the Talmidim and Rabbi Yochanan begin to put together all the discussions that were in their Beis Medrash over the last about 100 years since the time of the Chasimus HaMishnah. So there was a lot of discussion about the Mishnayos, a lot of kashas, a lot of terutzim, a lot of new shalos that came up, a lot of drushes, everything. So the Talmidim and Rabbi Yochanan began to put it together, to organize it, and this became the Talmud Yerushalmi. So the Talmud Yerushalmi is a misnomer. It's called Talmud Yerushalmi. It was not written in Yerushalayim, it was written in Tiberia, but it's called the Talmud Yerushalmi because it was basically the work of the Chachmei Eretz Israel, primarily the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan. The Talmud Yerushalmi, unfortunately, suffered greatly because it was put together very, very quickly. That apparently the editing that was done on the Talmud Bavli, which we'll talk about that a little bit later on, never really happened in the Talmud Yerushalmi. It was put together in a rush job, probably because of persecutions, that the situation was beginning slowly to deteriorate. We mentioned, right, that when once Rome accepted Christianity, the situation in Israel, Mamish, deteriorated very, very quickly. So already at this time, around the year 300 or so, things were not that great in Eretz Israel, and the bulk of the Talmidim were already on the way pretty much in Bavel, and as such, the Talmud Yerushalmi was put together fairly quickly. Because of that, there are a lot of the style of the Yerushalmi is difficult. That the style of Aramaic, the nuances of Aramaic are a little bit different. It wasn't it's like dialects. Yeah, different dialects of English also. Sometimes you have a person from South Africa talking to a person from New York. Sometimes they don't understand each other. So even though it was the same language, Aramaic, but it was a different dialect of Aramaic, and we are much more familiar with the Talmud Bavli's dialect. It's very difficult for us sometimes to read Yerushalmis. What makes that even more difficult in terms of learning Yerushalmi is that there are serious girsa problems, a lot of textual issues with Yerushalmis. Because Yerushalmi wasn't learned as often, it wasn't the critical as the Talmud Bavli was, we'll see a little bit later why. So therefore it was not as learned, it wasn't as popular. It was learned that when there were Yechidei school in each generation who were proficient in Yerushalmi, but it wasn't as popular. And unfortunately, in those days, the Middle Ages, when you had Svarim, it wasn't as popular, so then there were a lot of, everything was written by hand.
And sometimes texts start to make one mistake, and then if not everyone's necessarily correcting it so quickly, and sometimes mistakes start to creep in. So what happened was is that you had a combination of factors, that the text of Yerushalmi itself is difficult because it was never really edited properly, combined with the fact that the dialect of Aramaic is different than the one that we're more used to in terms of the Bavli, combined with the fact that there were many mistakes in terms of the textual mistakes that creeped into the Yerushalmi that made Yerushalmi for many, many people literally a closed book.
Why was it written in Aramaic?
Well, that was the language that was spoken in Israel. The people did not speak, I mean, Hebrew was Lashon HaKodesh, but the tongue on the street was Aramaic. There were Gedolei Olam over the years who always tried to salvage the Rishalmi, who tried to write Perushim on the Rishalmi, some famous ones, Korban Eida, Pnei Moshe, Baz, others. There was perhaps in our generation, so there's been a renaissance in terms of Rishalmi, perhaps more than any other generation. That's due to who? But the Ratzko, amazing concept. The Ratzko decided, after they finished everything else, they decided they're going to do the Talmud Yerushalmi. And they put together a team of great Talmid Chachamim, and it's a very, very difficult avoda. Those who are interested, they want to know the details about it, because it was Rabbi Talbis. Yaakov Talbis' father actually works on the side for Ratzko, and he works for one of the things that he works on is the Yerushalmi project. So I know all the ins and outs of this, because he happens to drive carpool with him every day. So he tells me all the difficulties in terms of working under Rishalmi, but he worked on one of the prachim in Masechah Shviyas is his. So by Rishalmi Shviyas, you can take a look. And he worked on one of the prachim in Oral also, and I'm sure he's working on some other stuff now. So this breakthrough in terms of our generation, only time will tell. In 100 years from now, people may look at the Rishalmi and say, hey, everyone can learn. Every yeshiva can learn Rishalmi also. So we've had an unbelievable schus that the Rishalmi is almost coming back. It's in the process of being brought back to life. You shouldn't think that it didn't exist. It existed the last 1500 years, but it was only really in the realm of real Talmid Chachamim with a lot of work in order to understand, to decipher the Rishalmi. Another reason why the Rishalmi has come back to life over the last 50 years or so is that Seder Zeroyim, there is no Bavli on Seder Zeroyim. So Seder Zeroyim, because it wasn't relevant in Bavel, they didn't really learn that much Trumas Maaseh Shviyas. It wasn't really relevant for them, except for Shmitas Ksofim, but okay, that was a hidden they found. But the Chachmei Bavel didn't spend as much time on those things, and therefore they did not write a Talmud Bavli on Zeroyim. So until 100 years ago, okay, so Zeroyim was also not relevant to Maisa. But now, since Baruch Hashem, Chrysal has returned and Master Eretz Israel, so all the sugyas that were sugyas to Maisa 1500 years ago in the Talmud Yerushalmi have now become critical again. So you have sugyas in Shviyas and Trumas and Maisas and Demai and Oral, all these things which were very much just academic until now, have Baruch Hashem come back to be Lamaisa. That has also rekindled interest in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Okay, so getting back to that period of time. So this was all taking place in Eretz Yisrael during two generations after the days of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. At the same time, there were developments in Bavel also, that there were tremendous yeshivas that were now functioning in Bavel with some of the major Amoraim we're familiar with, some of the Talmidim of Rav Shmuel. Who do we know? Who do we know some of the famous Talmidim of Rav Shmuel? Who were some of Rav's famous Talmidim? Rav Huna, think of all the Amar Huna Maravs. Or Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda Marav. Fava was not much later, a couple generations later. Who was some of the famous Talmidim of Shmuel? Amar of Nachman of Shmuel. Or Rav Yehuda was a Talmud of both. So sometimes you find Amar of Yehuda Marav, Amar of Yehuda Shmuel. So you had major plays also. Rav Shmuel, one of the only ones involved at the time. You had other Gedolim also. You had Levi, who had Yeshiva. He was also one of the Gedolim in Bavel. You had others who were also major plays in Bavel. But it was primarily Rav and Shmuel, their Tamidim, who make up the early generations of the Amorim. Then in Eretz Yisrael, the story pretty much starts to come to an end. And really, the end, the last major event that takes place in Eretz Yisrael in terms of the Torah Sheba Peh, until a couple hundred years later, takes place in a time of the period called Hil Hasheni. Hil Hasheni is the second Hillel, because to differentiate him between his great-great-great-great-grandfather Hil Hazak and the original Hillel. Hill Hasheni was the very end of the functioning of the Sanhedrin. We spoke about this a little bit earlier. And he realized that the Smicha, which we didn't even speak about Smicha really yet, hopefully we'll talk about that in the future. We spoke about that. Anyone who was with us in Tzfat? You were in my deal? Okay, so you heard the part about Smicha. We'll talk about that hopefully a little bit more berichos later on. So Hillel HaShani realized that Smicha, this authentic Smicha that can only be granted in Eretz Yisrael, was pretty much coming to an end because the Jewish community itself was coming to an end. With the dissolving of the Beis HaGadol, they ran into a very serious problem in terms of the Yom Tovim, in terms of Rosh Chodesh, because up until now, since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, Kiddush HaChodesh had always been in the hands of the Beis HaGadol. So now the question is, what do you do? So we spoke about this a little bit, right? We spoke about the Ramban, the Ramam, how do you do Rosh Chodesh today? So Hillel HaShani did something. Either he actually was Mekadosh HaChodesh, or he set up the calendar, whatever he did, but he set into motion the entire system of the calendar that we have at Hayom Hazeh. So that was a major, major breakthrough in terms of Tosha about that, but that was pretty much the end. After Hillel HaShani, so very, very little of major, major breakthrough happened there. It's still for a couple of hundred years. At this point now, the action had clearly moved to Babel. But even though, again, there were Jewish communities that were existing in other places, there were Jewish communities in Rome already at this point, and in other places in the world, but they were really, really the small. They were not where the action was. The action at this point revolved around the Jewish communities of Bavel, primarily the Mekomos of the yeshivas, Surah, and a new yeshiva that had been founded after the destruction of Nahadol, the yeshiva of Hadis, and others. And here you find, in these next couple of generations, the major, major players that we're familiar with, really the Chachmei Bavel. And who are these Amoraim? Just to throw out a few names that we're familiar with. I'll try to link them together with their respective pairs. You had Rab and Rav Yosef as one group. Then the next generation, you had Abai and Rava. Then you had the Tamidim of Rav. You had Rav Papa. And you had a little bit. You had other names that were. That are familiar to us a little bit later. You had Ravashi, Ravina, and you have this whole generation, the third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation, sixth generation, the whole Amoraim, this whole Tekufa of Babel, which is spanning from approximately the year 300 till approximately 477, I'm not mistaken, when the Chasimus Talmud Bavli. What began to happen now in the period of Ravashi, and Ravashi was talking about fourth, fifth generation of Amoraim and Bavel. What happened in the days of Rav Ashi was very similar to what happened in Eretz Yisrael by the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan, namely that there had been much discussion over the last 200 years or so in these great yeshivas in Bavel, which had focused primarily around the Mishnayos and around the kashas of the Mishnayos and the contradictions of the Mishnayos and the Brises and the early Amoraim's comments and so many other things, and then the drashim were thrown in, and the agadotas and stories and Musar and the and all kinds of different things that have been subject to discussion for hundreds of years. Rav Ashi decided to undertake to coordinate this, to organize it, and to put it into some shape or form, following along the lines of the Mishnah. So Rav Ashi did was, he started out with the Mishnah of Rabbi Danasi, some Amos HaKoros HaShrava Arvis. So now Rav Ashi put together all the discussions that had been taking place over the last 200 years in the yeshivas, which had revolved around this Mishnah. So some of the discussions were questions on the Mishnah, some of the discussions were Piskei Halacha relating to the Mishnah. Some of the discussions were Agadatas, statements that had somehow related to the Mishnah. And Rav Ashi began to combine them together and started off what we call the Talmud Bavli. Then his younger colleague, Ravina, continued, there were two Ravinas, this is the second Ravina, continued the work of Rav Ashi. And basically the Gemara says in Mabatsiya that Ravina and Rav Ashi were self-aranim, that they were really the final word in terms of the Psak Halacha, in terms of the Talmud Bavli. We mentioned in some of the early Shiurim that the Talmud Bavli was agreed upon by all the Chachm Yisrael. Everyone who lived in Bavel eventually came to accept the Talmud Bavli as being the final word of Tosh Bapeh. So here you have Mamish what's Munach in the Talmud Bavli, whatever we have in HaGemara, is Mamish the Yesedis of all the Tosh Bapeh that had been collected from the time of the Mishnah beforehand, and to the time of the Mishnah until the time of the Gemara, and everything in the Mishnah was all the Teshuvah Peah that had been collected from Moshe Rabbeinu to the times of Bidan Nasi. So when a person sits down, opens a Blat Gemara, sits and learns the Mishnah Gemara, Sugya in the Gemara, basically he is learning the Teshuvah Peah from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu to the days of Rav Ashi. That's considered to be the Ika Teshuvah Peah. And anybody who believes in Teres Moshe, so believes that the Talmud Bavli is the final psak in terms of Teres Moshe, person undermines the authority of the Talmud, doesn't believe in the Chachmei Gemara, questions the conclusions of the Chachmei Gemara, so basically is throwing into question the validity, the authenticity of all of Teres Shabbat Peh. So this is pretty much the final word in terms of Teres Shabbat Peh. Still, there are other things that are written, there are other svarim that are floating around that are authentic, that do have authority in Halacha, that don't make their way into the Talmud Bavli. There's what we call the Masechtas Ketanas. Anyone knows what those are? They're like compilations of different brises. There's Masechtas Smachos, which deals with certain halachas of Avelos. There's Masechtas Sofrim, deals with certain Sefer Torah and other things, Tefillah. You have a Masechtas Derech Eretz. You have a few handfuls of Masechtas Kalim, Masechtas Gerim. You have a bunch of different Masechtas. So they were written by the Chachmei HaMesorah, but they're not included in the Talmud Bavli. We usually do pass them like things that appear in the Svarim, not always. If they contradict the Bavli, then we don't accept them. Just as we don't accept Yerushalmi when it contradicts the Bavli. So this was pretty much the contribution of Ravina and Rav Ashi, this major, major contribution. And of course, all this was actually put into writing following the precedent already of Mishnah, that the Torah Shabbat Peh, we're afraid is going to be forgotten. It can be put into writing. And now what happened, just as after the period of the Mishnah, all the learning began to revolve around the Mishnah, all the discussion, all the further discussion began to revolve around the Mishnah. So the exact same thing happened at the Chasimus HaGemara, that all the discussion we got to focus primarily around the Talmud Bavli. That became the, in a sense, the new Mishnah. Just as the Mishnah, in a sense, becomes the, I don't mean Chalil in the bad way, the new Torah, but just as the previous Tashim Rapeh became the Mishnah, now the Mishnah becomes the Gemara, and all discussion begin and focuses the later, the Gaonim, the Rishon, the Chronim, everything revolves and works around the Gemara. Even though the Gemara was officially completed by Ravina and Rav Ashi, there was a little bit of touch-up job, editing work that was done by the next generation. Anyone knows what the next generation were?
Savarayim.
They were called the Savarayim. It's interesting because we wouldn't even know that they existed because the Gemara doesn't talk about them. They were post the Gemara. But we know most about them from a letter of Rav Shmuel Gaon. Rav Shmuel Gaon was one of the Gaonim. We'll talk about them a little bit later on. Rav Shmuel Gaon describes a lot of the things that I've been talking about, his famous Igeret. And in this letter of Shirigon, he tells us about the work of the Savaroyim, that the Savaroyim were that next generation after the official closing of the Gemara, that they did a little bit of editing to the Gemara itself, in terms of just touching up the style of the Gemara a little bit. And actually, there are a few sugyas here and there that are not technically from the period of Ravina and Ravash, and actually from the next generation, from the Tamidim, the Savaroyim. Anybody knows which ones? There's one or two sugyas, a couple of sugyas in Shas that are later than the rest of the Gemara. They were put in a little bit later on. Again, talking 30, 40 years, not talking about 500 years later. Anyone know? Does anyone remember the beginning of Sabbath Kedushim?
Yeah.
Remember that whole first daf about why does it say three, why does it say Jerachim and Devarim? So that's like a very unstylistic of the Gemara. Usually the Gemara doesn't go into such minute details about the grammar and this. So the Rishonim write that we have a tradition that particular daf was put in by the Savaroyim, that it wasn't from the Chachmei Gemara itself. Doesn't mean you should learn it. So it's a technical execution begins at Daf Gimel. But that's one example. Anyone knows any others? There are a few lines. There's a line in the middle of Avakam in the sixth parak that many claim comes from the period of the Savaroyim. Again, the Savaroyim were the Tamidim, they were the next generation after the Amoraim, but still they were after the Chasimus HaGemara. So the Gemara Lamaisa, the Gemara is finalized and is accepted by everybody, and really not soon enough, because just as Ravi Dan Nossi had, Yisburuch HaKodesh, had realized that he better get the Mishnah into writing quickly. So too Ravashi, Rabbeinu Ravashi got the Gemara into writing quickly, because eventually the Jewish community is going to disperse significantly. Kozman, the Jewish community, was in Babel, there was still some degree of unity. Once the Jewish community began to disperse further throughout the world, then that unity is broken, and the only way to keep the Klai Yisrael together is to have at least one common focus, one common final word. There can be machlokes about how to interpret things in the Gemara, but at least everyone's working in the same Gemara. So this is what began to happen. If you're talking about the Middle Ages, you're talking from the year 500 till about the year 1000. So you begin to see Jewish communities really beginning to take form in different parts of the world. You find this the very beginnings, the very roots of the division between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jewry at this time. You find that that there's a Jewish community that's beginning to crop up in Spain, and you find another Jewish community that's beginning to crop up in Germany. Many of the Jews who came from Germany, many of the historians claim that they actually had come originally from Italy. They had been parts of many of the Shvuyim, many of the captives that the Romans had taken from Eretz Israel. We know for a fact that there were many captives that were taken from Eretz Israel. We know for a fact that there was a Jewish community in Rome, a functioning Jewish community at the time, even at the time the time before the Churban, there was a Jewish community there, but after the Churban, for sure there was. And we know that Rabbi Masim ben Choresh, who mentioned him before, was the Rav, was the Rosh Yeshiva in Rome. So we know there was a Jewish community in Rome early on in terms of this period. And this Jewish community had began to migrate from Italy into Germany. And really the Jewish communities, the forerunners of Ashkenazi Jewry, were beginning to come into place now, to the 800s, 900s, etc. But suffice it to say that probably most of us were sitting in this room, most of us, at least those Ashkenazim, were sitting in the room. So we're talking about individuals who are our great, 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 great grandfathers. I mean, a couple of greats added on. Since we all, anyone who comes from Poland or from Russia or from Hungary or Lithuania, that part of the world, so eventually we were all Yakis at one time. They all came, all those Jews of Eastern Europe had all originally come from Germany. And many of these Jews had actually come from originally from Italy, would come originally from Eretz Israel. At the same time that the Jewish community in Italy is developing, the Jewish community in Germany is developing, there's a Jewish community in Spain that's developing as well, which becomes a forerunner of many of the Sephardic communities in the future. There's also a Jewish community that is developing in Italy, besides just in Rome, another place in Italy, their Jewish community is developing. Their Jewish community is beginning to develop in North Africa at the time, which is going to become a major, major center of Torah. Those who know a little bit about the geography, North Africa is not all that far from Spain. Spain. It's just a little, just over the, just hop over Gibraltar, a little hop over the Mediterranean. So you're beginning to see now this diversification in terms of the Jewish communities, which could potentially have been a disaster in terms of Torah Shavuot Peh, because there wouldn't have been at least some compilation of Torah Shavuot Peh at this time. So then it would have been you would have seen mamish not based terrorists, there'd been 100 terrorists. So what happened was that Baruch Hashem, Ravina Rav Ashi had the Siyata Deshmaya to compile the Gemara, and soon afterward, when these communities began to take a life on their own, the influence of the Jewish communities in Bavel began to wane. But before that happened, there was a whole period of time called the Tkufas HaGaonim. So after the Sabaroyim, after about the years 500 or so, until about the year 1000, the whole period of the Middle Ages, so the Gaonim, or the Rosh Yeshivas in Bavel, some of the Gaonim were famous to us, many of them, we do know them by name, many of them were not as famous to us. Who were some of the famous Gaonim? Rasaji was perhaps the most famous of all of them. Rahim Singh Rasaji was the only one, at least until that time, who was not actually born in Bavel. He was born in Egypt, if I'm not mistaken. Rav Chaim Gaon was very, very end. He was Rav Shmuel Gaon's son. The Vilna Gaon was much, much later. But the Gaon was not a Bavel. But we can tell the greatness of him that he gave the name the Gaon. So you have just a few names again. Rav Sadja Gaon, Rav Chaim Gaon, Rav Shmuel Gaon, Rav Amram Gaon, a very famous sitter. Rav Chaim Gaon, a lot of Gaonim over the course of those years. And these Gaonim were still functioning as the central authority to a lesser degree in for Klal Yisrael, lesser degree than the times of the Gemara. Many Shailas were sent to Bavel, many Shailas in writing were sent to Bavel, and the Gaonim wrote many, many tshuvas in writing to different far-flung Jewish communities. In fact, the Geras Rosh Uragon was a letter that was a response to a whole series of questions that was sent from North Africa, by the Rabbanim of North Africa, to Babel, asking primarily about the development of Toshiva Peh. So most of this Shir was asked to Rosh Uragon, and he had access to all the records, all the documents, because he was a Rosh Hashiva in Babel at the time. So he had a lot of access to all this historical information. And we found also that many people came to learn about the Gaonim, and then sometimes people from other Jewish communities would come, and then they would go back to their communities, and they would bring back many of the Mesoras, many of the Pesukei Halacha from the Gaonim. So we do find that Bavel is still playing a major, major role in terms of Toshiva Peh, but not quite as powerful a role as it did in the times of the Gemara. And the role of Bavel has pretty much going to come to an end around the year 1000, and that's when we enter into the next period of Jewish history in terms of the Toshiva Peh, and that's the Tkufas HaRishonim. So pretty much the cutoff point between the end of the Gaon and the Rishonim is pretty much around the year 1000. It's usually, the cutoff point is usually around the death of Rav Haigon. Rav Haigon died around the year 1000. So he's considered to be like the end of the Gaonim, and the Rif is pretty much born at that point. So he's considered to be pretty much like the beginning of the period of the Rishonim. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit more tomorrow night, Shia, just how exactly the period of the Rishonim plays out and how the Toshiva Peh continues to develop.